This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. I'm talking today to Jess Brouwer, whose name I will never pronounce correctly.
Brouwer, yeah. Okay.
And we're going to talk about a lot of different things because Jess has a lot of different things in his background. Maybe before I ask you questions, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, you don't have to tell the, like, in massive detail, but you, I mean, aside from working in the publishing industry, you also have written 31 books or more and created a lot of really interesting products. So I want to kind of let the folks know who don't know your work know a little bit more about you. So you could maybe give a brief bio.
Sure. I entered publishing to do marketing with Trade Division. Started Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch and had the good luck to work both there and at Little Brown and work with some really amazing, you know, authors from Tracy Kidder to William Manchester to Norman Mailer to Lillian Hellman, Nias Nin. It was a really incredible selection of authors at that point. Did some interesting things around marketing, caused a few bestsellers that people would not have seen or expected to happen. That's always a lot of fun. And then
this would be in what time frame? What
time period? We're talking, good grief, 79 through 85, something like that. Yeah. So some of the good old days of publishing. It depends on how you look at it, but got to work with some really great authors and got to do some interesting things with their books and put a couple books on the bestseller list. And then I went off and decided to do what I what first got me into publishing, which was a little bit of writing. I wrote a couple of humor books, actually. They're really, really classy Donald Trump quiz book a long time ago. And I did something called The Pessimist Journal, a very, very bad days. You can see these are classics. I did the hot dog cookbook, The Wiener Work, The World Awaited, and and eventually thought it might be wise for myself and my family if I got back into publishing, and I had a chance to get back in Addison Wesley, which was a really interesting company at that time because it had a trade division, but it was an education company. Anyway, we did really well there in terms of the proportion of books that we put on the bestseller list. While I was the director of marketing there, we did Friday Night Lights, we did Iron John, we did Mama Makes Up Her Mind, or again, sort of doing unexpected and surprising books. And that's when I first started to feel that maybe my strength was to do things that, again, were unexpected, were interesting, were even contrarian to what everyone else is doing. There seemed to be opportunity to do things differently from how every other publisher was doing it. And I had a chance while at Addison Wesley to develop a children's line of informal learning books for kids, basically two age ranges, 4 to 7 and 8 to 12. And I had one book which was really a stealth learning health science book. And I thought that the covers of books were not being used smartly. It was really important real estate. And when I walked into a huge bookstore, it seemed extraordinarily important that that cover of that book somehow caused the book to move to the cash register. So I put fake vomit on the front of it. And I remember no one wanted to take it. I remember Barnes & Noble did not want to take it. My imprint was sort of on the line, and I went to the buyer, went with the sales rep down to the buyer of Barnes & Noble, and I said, just please put, you know, I'll give you 3,000 copies of this book and put it in the Fifth Avenue window and let's see what happens. And 4 days later, I had another order of 6,000 and that took off and went on to become a 6-month New York Times bestseller list. And I really am afraid that my epitaph will be the man who put fake vomit on a book. But then I actually got over to some digital publishing at that point. That imprint, that children's imprint, for corporate reasons, I actually ended up at Penguin, which is a really nice place, obviously, to have a children's imprint. But I went from there over to Internet 1.0 and, again, was looking for an opportunity to do something that was a little bit contrarian but also smart. And I had the good fortune of having a lot of talented people working with me because what I wanted to do was publish narrative, publish stories, publish something to kids all who were on PC screens at that time, long before social media, long before mobile devices. And I thought, you know, that screen, these kids are spending a lot of time on there. And they're in school, they're at home, they're at public library, school library. what kind of content would work on that screen that could tell a story. And I thought it should be visual because kids had that expectation. I thought it should be funny because funny's always good. And then I thought it should be consumed in chunks because kids got kicked off their classroom computer, got kicked off the library computer, and dad at night kicked them off the home computer. And this gentleman named Jeff Kinney was working with me at the time. He was my design manager, and he told me he had a book, and he called it Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And I looked at it, and I said, holy smoke, this is chunks. It's a diary. He's an ex-comic strip creator. It was very visual, and it was funny as hell. And I said, Jeff, I don't know how we're going to do this, but let's publish this onto a PC screen. So we published Diary of a Wimpy Kid onto a site that I managed at that time called Funbrain. It's a rather large site. And within 4 months, we had 80,000 kids per day reading it. It took 2 years to find a book publisher for it. This is sort of one of the tales of children's publishing these days. It was turned down twice by Penguin, and it was turned down by every major house. And then luckily, Jeff found an editor at Abrams who really appreciated it.
Charlie Kochman,
yeah. He got it. He understood it. He offered, I think, in 5 minutes to buy it. And at that point, it traveled to the bestseller list fast as anything I've ever seen. I think it hit the New York Times list maybe within about 4 weeks, very fast. And it's never, ever, ever slowed down and is now, I think
11th or 12th book.
It's about the 11th or 12th book. He's got a series of diaries. He's done a couple of like there was a Write Your Own one in there somewhere. There was a movie diary because it went on to do three different movies. Right. It's now a musical in Minneapolis, which I'm delighted to say I'm going to go see in a couple of weeks. And it's supposedly very good. We'll hopefully go on a national tour and end up at Broadway at some point, hopefully. But it's the best-selling book in the world, I think, for the last 7 years. I think it's in 44 languages. So that was really wonderful to think all that's resulted from that decision to put that on a PC screen. It's also very interesting because it would never have reached all those different languages. It would never have been a musical if it had not gone into print at some point to go onto a bestseller list.
Right.
And then the bestseller list allows movies and allows translations and allows musicals and stuff like that. So one of the lessons learned there was, it's pretty cool to do the web publishing, but you really had to get back to print to have it validated, to have it curated, to have it endorsed by parents, teachers, educators, and then it can really, really take off.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. Yeah. So since then, that was a while ago.
That was a while ago. So then Jeff and I think we high-fived each other when he hit the bestseller list. And then we looked at each other and said, I think we have a problem. Because in that 2 years of trying to find a publisher and all that time that we had that book on the PC screen, kids had started to move over from a site like FunBrain, which is informal learning games, over to virtual worlds, over to places where the gaming was much better, in all honesty, than some of the more simpler learning-based games, where kids create an avatar and engage in multi-level games. And that, to me, was a really interesting challenge because now if kids were going to be engaged in virtual worlds, it was still, I sort of took it as my responsibility. I think Jeff joined me on that. We need to tell kids stories no matter what they're doing. Every generation of kids needs to be told stories to carry on traditions and introduce them to the world in which they live. And so that was our challenge. And so Jeff said, we have illustrators and I could write this, but what we need is a back-end programmer and a front-end programmer. And luckily at the time we had ownership that thought that that was a good idea and allowed us to do that. And so we started telling stories within a virtual world. And they were, again, sort of all the way back to those days at Addison Wesley where I was doing a stealth learning. We would, send kids on a counterfeit art story and it caused them to go to the different art museums around the world and they had to learn different things about different artists. But it was all this sort of stealth learning, soft learning, but kids were really enjoying it, being engaged in that game. We had kids going over Mount Everest and going under the water and figuring out how things worked in space, a whole bunch of different stories. And anyway, it was really 14 months to the day after we got the funding. We woke up and discovered we were the largest kid site in the world. We weren't aiming to do that, but someone noticed that, and that was absolutely delightful. We had 8 million kids per month from...
This is Pop Tropica?
This is Pop Tropica, yeah. Thank you, David. It's Pop Tropica. Hugely popular. Kids would spend an average of 30 minutes on each visit. So kids were spending 1,760 years per month on the site. I love the statistics are fun. But it's really amazing how engaging it was. And it was really delightful that it was a story-based site that turned out to be, at that time, the most popular site in the world. And then I have now moved on from Pop Tropica, and I like to think that I'm on to my next cool thing that I'm going to do in terms of telling stories to kids, and I think it has something to do with short-form animation on mobile devices.
Which is very... Yeah.
That was really a very detailed overview.
That's pretty good. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, that sort of sets us up so we can talk about, you know, kind of, I'm interested in your sense of the evolution, which you've been through, you know, since you've, and of course, it is wrong to think of it as a sort of linear evolution, because as you said, there's print is still there.
Yeah.
That's kind of an interesting phenomenon. And as many publishers have noticed, children's print books are doing really well, and children's ebooks are not, which I think does not prove one thing. It actually may be evidence of another thing. But it's almost like, okay, digital storytelling done in a simplistic way cannot compete with digital storytelling done in a sophisticated way.
Right.
And I think that, you know, the multi-level games and the virtual worlds, you know, which my kids have certainly participated in, are rich and full of story in a way that if you look at their kind of equivalent so-called converted ebooks are pretty flat, pretty dull.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that I believe that books have to be gamified in order to be successful, but I do think you have to tell stories that take advantage of the platform or take advantage of the situational environment.
For me, it was – that's very interesting, David. For a while, for me, it was putting content or a story in front of kids wherever they were. And I remember at one point I realized – on vacation in a beach shop somewhere that the inflatable raft was 14 by 14. I was thinking, well, why can't I print something on that raft? Because that almost fits in a book rack.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that would be a chance when the kid blew it up to be learning about starfish and tides, and while they're laying there waiting for the wave to come in or they're sunning, they could be reading. So it was like a book on a raft. And I remember I did a book called It's Snot Tissues, which was printing basically trivia on tissues that were then in a tissue box. And so the theory was a kid was homesick and blowing his nose, and every time he went to blow his nose, he, you know, read a brain teaser or read something or whatever.
So a little bit like Bazooka with the cartoon in the chewing gum.
Yeah.
Essentially, what you're doing is it's wherever you are.
Yeah.
Whatever, give me a tool, I'll use it.
Yeah, and so I don't think it's, I think wherever you are is still informing, even with technology, because I get the feeling that kids consume differently at the moment, you know, whether it's bedtime or whether it's when they're with their mobile device somewhere, whether they're traveling. I think this is true with adults, too. I mean, I don't want to get off track there, but I think one of the mistakes or it's not even a mistake. Just one of the things people got off track with in book publishing was that the mobile device is going to be about ebooks. And I think it's really been more about audiobooks. And that's just, no matter where I travel, no matter where I'm looking around, I see those earbuds in constantly. And I see the growth of podcasts and TED Talks. And I think people are engaging in information and thankfully really high quality information, and they're doing it while they're commuting, they're doing it while they're on the train, it's through audio. And
I think that's a really good point. And of course, we're recording this in an audiobook studio, so they, you know, we're surrounded by people who are engaged in that work.
Right.
You know, one of the I met a guy a couple of days ago who told me that he consumes about 500 books a year all audiobooks. That's a lot of books. But he's in his car all the time. Yeah. You know, he's doing that work where he's alone and can put the earbuds in. And, I mean, I think, though, that it does imply that there's a big potential market there.
Yeah, and I don't think it's actually... I think it's growing like crazy, audiobooks are, and I almost feel like people aren't thinking about it. If I sit down and have a conversation with a good publisher, a good editor, they're really thinking print and they're thinking ebooks. And it's not like they don't quite get that third thing said yet. And yet I think that becomes increasingly important. I mean, I don't see any reason why I as a publisher, I wouldn't be uptight what percentage of my revenue comes off of any one of those formats. If it's 20% print and 30% ebook and 50 audio, I'm perfectly happy with that, right? I mean, we're all here just to try to inform people and entertain people and tell kids stories, and so let them consume it the way they want to. I'm curious about the point that you made, and I think everyone in the industry is curious about this sort of leveling off of ebooks with kids and this sort of return to the printed book. And I hear a lot of things that are theories, and I, you know, read the industry journals, and there's some perhaps research that suggests things, but I've engaged with kids, had conversations who just, they want a story and they realize if they read it on their phone, they're distracted constantly. They really set the mobile device aside and they sit down with their printed book, which doesn't beep at them or yell at them or, you know, take them off in some other direction. And I'm not surprised by that. I think everyone sort of self-regulates, right? When you're too much coffee or not enough sleep or whatever, you correct that. And I have to believe that kids who are so immersed in social media and so connected to their phone do have the innate ability or instinct to, you know, sort of wind down, regulate, engage in a book. So I think that's one of the things that's going on. And also libraries are very important to the age that I've often published for, which is that middle grade age, 8 to 12. A lot of people, a lot of those kids discover their books in libraries, at Scholastic Book Fairs, for example. And when a book starts getting handed around at a sleepover or in the cafeteria after school, summer camp, bus trip, whatever, I think the book starts to move. And Wimpy Kid was a great example. I mean, we had that. His first three books were created from the material we had online, which is still online today. And, you know, we had millions of kids reading that over all those years. And they still rush out to buy the book. And I think there's just something about it.
Well, you know, it's sort of it's something I've thought about a lot, that with the sharing component, you know, this idea that, like, I read the book. Harry Potter's a good example. Kids would read Harry Potter and then another kid would say, I got to read that book now. You know, I see you're so involved in it. And, of course, with ebooks, you can't do that, period. It also works that way in schools and libraries where they don't have endless amounts of money at this point. Right. Schools are mostly under budgetary pressure, so are libraries. So having the physical books that are shareable and kind of easily reusable, you know, it makes me wonder if publishing has missed an opportunity in the way that it's trying to control the circulation of ebooks.
I think you may be onto something there. That's everyone's bugaboo on ebooks is it's not shareable, and it's a tipping point thing. I mean, all publishing, we didn't call it tipping point; we called it word of mouth. At some point, you know, for every single book, you try to do something: reviews, publicity, free copies. You try to get it in circulation, get it shared, get it moved, and it hits a tipping point. Boom, you go to a bestseller list. And that ebook, just because it's not as shareable, just may slow down the process in some of these books. Right. That's really interesting.
And what I don't, and then the question, the sort of corollary, which I know is the kind of the logic that's in place. It's that it's a zero sum game. If I give away or make it easy for people to share ebooks because of quote pirating, you know, the worry is those books will kill the sale of print books. Now, no one wants to do the experiment to find out whether that's true or not. My suspicion is, as you've been saying, that the book is an artifact that still has value for kids, in enough value that you would think that the piracy or the, you know, moving ebooks around wouldn't really detract from the sale of print books. But I can't prove it, and no one is going to be able to prove it without trying that experiment, and most publishers probably are not in a position to take that risk. But it would be really interesting to, and maybe Wimpy Kid is a good example. I mean, you have millions of people reading it online. You have millions of people reading it in print. You know, Seth Godin might argue, you just proved his entire point. And giving away ebooks may be the key, or making them easily shareable or more readily shareable and less expensive may in fact have a marketing value that has been underestimated. Again, I can't prove it, and it would be difficult to try to convince a publisher of that.
Yeah, I mean, you do read some articles from time to time. I feel like I've been reading them for 10 years now about free content, let content go free, but tear down the barriers. And it's usually, articles are probably written by someone somewhat younger with some investment money with some sort of tech device that they want to sell. But it's always caught my eye. I always thought there was something to it. And I think in part because of the Wimpy Kid experience and the PopTropic experience, we always had our sites free. And we would use our sites and our huge audiences to brand something, which then would increase its licensing value. So then you license it out as a book, or you license it out as a movie or whatever. But, you know, maybe one of the problems with the book industry is that it's very difficult, I think, to be brave at the top of an organization that has such a very, very, very low margin. I mean, you do an experiment, you take a brave position, and you can
get killed.
You can get killed. It could be very dangerous.
Yeah.
And so I don't quite know what to do about that. But
I don't think you're doing
9 or 10% margin, and suddenly you deliver 2%.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, it is easy to sit outside and suggest to people that their business models are kind of out of date and you should do it differently. But it's much harder to sit in the in the office and be the one who is making that decision.
Yeah, you've got owners, you've got a full staff there. You don't want them to lose their jobs, lose their benefits. I'm very sympathetic, having sat atop a couple of organizations, very sympathetic to that. It's not easy to be brave out there sometimes.
You have a pretty close involvement with kids and kids reading. I mean, you actually, you write books still. And I'm kind of curious to know, based on not only all the experience you've had, but kind of your feelings about the current environment for kids. And let's say we're talking about, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds, that sort of chapter book readers, slightly under YA. I'm just curious about them, and how they're, what is happening in their world, this highly branded, materialistic, commoditized world where, kids are always trying to establish their own culture and escape being marketed to. And, I don't have a good sense of what is going, what those kids are about. I know, we hear a lot about they have younger and they're at earlier and earlier ages getting devices. They're completely fluent with technology. Most of them have cell phones, maybe 10, 11 years old. Not most, but many kids have cell phones at that age. Almost all kids have played video games. They're very conversant. Do you have a sense of how that is potentially changing the way they interact with information and with each other?
Oh, I guess some random thoughts about that. It is my favorite spot to publish to, that 8, 9, 10, and 11. Before, earlier, when you get down to 4 to 7, it's really completely parent-driven. And that's,
I mean, that the parents and grandparents buy the books, or teachers or librarians. The kids are not in a position. I mean, they might want, but they're pretty much not in control of
They've not learned how to nag enough to get the one the book that they want. Right. They're in the process of developing that
skill. So maybe up to third grade,
they're kind
of in the position of somebody is making decisions for them about what they're going to read.
Yeah, I think it's really just sort of following child development. You know, it's like you want to publish how children develop, and that may, some things may change by a year or so, but still, you know, kids, you know, they start out, they're comforted by their parents, they're introduced to their neighborhood, they're introduced to their school, and at some point they've got to start having some independence, so they start wanting to have their own brands. They want to read, engage, watch TV, do a film, wear clothing that's peer-approved as opposed to parental-approved. And then that's when, if you have a powerful brand, you can really take off with it. It's also, you can just get killed with it too. And that, if that brand moves up or down, I think that was sort of the classic story, I hope I have this right, with Goosebumps when it was first so marvelous that there was, I remember going to a conference and the brand manager for Goosebumps stood up and I was going to hear How to Be Brilliant, because obviously whoever was publishing and managing Goosebumps is brilliant. And it was in October in Arizona, and he stood up and announced that Goosebumps was over. And it's like, this is a clever presentation. But he was serious, because that September, Goosebumps had gone down to kindergarten. Kindergarten kids were wearing Goosebumps T-shirts. They were bringing Goosebumps lunchboxes. And suddenly, if you're a fourth grader, you don't want to have the brand that your loser little brother or sister had.
Right.
And that they just went too far down, and they lost it. And, you know, it went quiet for a long time before it's been again revived in those generations, and that generation has passed through. But, publishing to kids is insane also, because they're in your market for such a short period of time. I've always been jealous of, you know, like the Financial Times. They grab a reader at age 29. They've gotten for 40 years, and they got their credit card, you know. And if you're publishing to kids, you know, you catch them, and you do 2-3 lists to them, and they've moved on. But I've also always enjoyed publishing with constraint. You know, it's like, okay, that's another challenge. That's part of the obstacle course. But we still need to publish quality content to those kids. And they're going to make it difficult because they're going to fall in love with us. They're going to fall out of love with us. And then they're going to grow up and move out. And we got to go right back to work on the next kid coming up. But I think if you publish following child development, and know that a kid needs to get a little bit ornery at a certain age and be independent, and you publish with a little bit of humor to that, and, you know, a little bit of wisecracking to that.
Let me ask you about that, the humor. Really interested in the idea of humor for kids. That seems to evolve. Now, the basic principles of humor do not, but the context has to change. You know, like what was funny for somebody like us growing up, you know, our age is not that dissimilar.
Right.
You know, whatever. We saw the Three Stooges.
Right.
When we were kids, black and white, Three Stooges, Abbott and Costello. That was funny, right? But you know what? My kids thought Three Stooges was the stupidest thing they ever saw in their life. So what, you know, I would think that humor is very ephemeral in a sense that you have to be, you have to have the language of the day, the kind of culture of the day somewhere in your thought stream and you can't fake it. You know, that's, humor cannot be faked.
Yeah, I think, you know, those Abbott, Costello, Three Stooges, those are interesting examples, because I think what's really important that I've seen over the last 8 years in publishing again to that 8 to 12-year-old is if you root your storytelling inside of a school, inside of a middle school, or inside of a family, that has enduring sets of standards, and it's very universal. You know, it's like National Lampoon's Vacation. It just sort of works across generations, you know, everyone's got their Chevy Chase dad, or they know someone like that. So I think, you know, Three Stooges is not in the school or in the family, neither is Abbott and Costello, but I think that middle grade publishing, again, if the setting is school or the setting is family, I think it's universal. And I see how some of these books, again, I'm, I not plugging it, but again, Wimpy Kid has traveled so well around the globe and is now really on a second or third generation of readers. And I think it's because it nails middle school. And in that beginning, you know, there were no cell phones in any of those characters. So it was really the humor that was working. I had a lunch today and I had a conversation where I was talking to two different mothers who want their kids to read, whose kids read, who buy books. And they were sort of challenged to find humor above Wimpy Kid, that because there's a lot in there now. And they were sort of saying, I want Dave Barry for my, you know, for my child, or I want Bill Bryson for my...
Right, but kids older than the 8, 9, 10-year-olds, now they're looking at young adult more, like 13, 14, 15. And you're saying that they're not seeing the humor.
Yeah. A lot of these kids will move to film at that point, and that's okay for families because they can watch films together, etc. But I think humor starts to get back to your challenge, Dave, after that middle school setting. And I think there's a sweet spot in there if someone can figure it out.
Maybe high school humor, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, high schoolers are weird. They're half adults or half. Yeah. Some of them, their voices haven't cracked. Some of them, their beards aren't growing yet. It would be a challenge.
I would be really interested to know if you showed Fast Times at Ridgemont High in a high school today, what would happen? Would it resonate for them? Because some of that stuff, some of those high school things are universal.
Yes.
You know, like I've been in high schools over the years, and I would say the social milieu, even though, again, it changes, the outer appearances change, but an awful lot of the social stuff.
Yeah, the breakfast.
Just like you were saying with family is reliable, I would think that high school is pretty reliable in terms of relationships. You know, difficult, really hard to be. I think it's hard to be a kid. It's really hard to be.
Oh yeah, so I wouldn't want to do it. But I've always just enjoyed that middle grade area because it's kids making their own choices, whether they're bugging their parents for the purchase or whether they're being empowered to go to Scholastic Book Fair and buy it or whatever. And younger kids, it's like the parents make the decisions, and I find that kids after that are really confusing and really challenging. And I think I could probably burn through a lot of money trying to make sense of that one. It's dangerous. So
in terms of your own writing today, and I know your son is writing now.
Yeah, my son's writing. He had a book published today. Second Galactic Hot Dogs book. So
right, and I saw Galactic Hot Dogs at I forget, maybe it was at New York Comic Con. They were doing a big promotion for it.
Right,
looked really good.
Yeah, it's a great book. He's actually a very successful writer. He's one of whatever it is, 900 people make a living off of writing, so God bless him.
And did you feel like he picked that up from, I mean, he must have picked that up from you.
I find it astounding that someone could grow up sitting at a dining room table with the old man bitching about publishing every single day and you somehow end up in it. But his path to it, to me, is really interesting because the books that were bedside to him were scripts. He loved films first. He's one of millions of kids at first. Star Wars just, you know, changed his life at some young age, and it was always going to be film, film, films. And he read scripts all the time, and then he sort of did a little bit of a movie industry thing and then got into writing and into publishing. And I think he writes, you know, he writes tightly because he was reading scripts his whole life. And then he delivers to his publishers on time because he worked in the TV and the film industry, and you could not go another day on the set. You could not bring the caterers back. You could not rent the equipment again. You could not take this block of Manhattan for another day. And so I think it's really has served him well. I guess I'm surprised. I mean, my father's a dentist, and the last thing I wanted to be in life was a dentist because all I heard was horrible things about being a dentist.
It's a little different being a... Yeah. So are there writing ideas that you think about that you want to do that you haven't done, or do you have
A lot of, you know, I'm very practical about this. I did pre-web, I wrote... a lot of actually just like collections. I was more of an editor than a writer. I did, you know, I did collections of quotes for medical people, and for I did a book called The Cocktail Hour, which is obviously about drinking. I did a book of quotes for coaches, though that there would be a gift for the Little League coach, blah, blah, blah. I did a whole set of those. And then, although I think this is not true, when the internet hit, everyone said, why do I need a quote book? I can go up to the internet and get it. But they sort of missed it. It's a gift book. So
Yeah, and the curation context is actually meaningful.
And I actually see a lot being published now in a way that they weren't 10 years ago. I think people realized that was very important. As I said, some of the books I wrote early on were humor books, and that was a lot of fun. But again, they tended to be collections. The book I'm most proud of is a children's book I did called Tessa's Tree, which is a very simple little picture book that was inspired by the child of a friend who she lost her favorite tree and had a funeral for it. And I thought it was a very touching story, and I realized I could go back into my own childhood, and I realized that loss, the first time you lose something, is really awful. If you lose a grandparent, for example, or a pet, you have these feelings like your chest is tight and your stomach's not well, and if you're a kid, you've never had these feelings before. And as adults, we know what that is. It's, you know, it's loss, it's grief. We know that it's going to get better. But for a kid, it must be really scary. So I thought that Tessa's Tree was a nice example of introducing kids to loss and then sort of the healing and hope that comes with it. And I was very lucky because my good friend Peter Reynolds said he'd like to illustrate it. And Peter's extraordinarily successful, a really good guy. And it was online for a long time. It was sort of, I was doing that around the same time we did Wimpy Kid, and then we had a really nice job of Harper published it, but it never really took off for some reason. And I'm working on another picture book. It's a little bit like that right now. I don't know if anything will come of it. So no, my own writing's always been sort of, I think it comes out of my marketing background. I look on a bookshelf and notice something. Sometimes I notice something that's really dumb, like there's no hot dog cookbook there. Well, then I'll write a hot dog cookbook. There should be a hot dog. And then I'll go out and some poor publisher will get suckered into spending money on a hot dog cookbook, and we'll prove once again that there's no need for a hot dog cookbook. It's the whole point of a hot dog. You don't need a cookbook for it.
Boil it, fry it, you know.
Yeah, right. It's already cooked. I mean, really, it's a really dumb idea. But so I quite often what I'll do is I'll see that there's not something on the bookshelf that I think there should be, that there's a market for. If I can't do it, I'll pass it off to someone else. Early on, I was passing it off to my son Max, and actually the first few books he did, a couple of them were sort of ideas that I had thrown in his direction before he got to do his own stuff. So
do you think there's a anything? I mean, if you're just saying you could be like the master of all publishing, what do you think is the like the thing that needs to be done that isn't happening? You know, the thing that take away all the, you know, the constraints. Like, what do you think really should, that somebody should do?
Well, okay, I talked about how difficult it is to run a publishing house because of the very weak margins they're operating on. It may be their own fault for I know at this point. But I would simply be determined to bring some sort of innovation, some sort of contrarian notion, not just to be contrarian, but to be smart to the business. I mean, I am not surprised that everything that's happened to publishing in the last 10 years has come from outside of publishing. It's Amazon, it's Apple, it's Google. There's people outside there thinking, and the publishers aren't doing the thinking. And I'm really afraid they're giving up their customers to some extent. They're giving up their influence to a great extent. And I think that it's an industry that's staffed and populated by people who are passionate, who care. That's the only reason you're in this business, because you don't make much money in it. And you got to live, for the most part, in New York, which is ridiculous in terms of cost. And yet, they just I know they're exhausted. They go in the office at 8 and they just sort of take care of going through the routines, the model that's been in place for since the end of World War II. 6 years ago, they added to their work by throwing in e-books at them, and they go home exhausted at 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. And there's no capacity in there to just stop and just think. And I would maybe roll the dice. And I had the opportunity to work at Pearson, which was run by a wonderful woman named Margie Scardino, and she had the capacity to always develop that sort of innovative culture while we were there. She's the one that said, yeah, go ahead and do Pop Tropica. Yeah, go ahead and do Wimpy Kid. It's fine. If you blow $400,000 on Pop Tropica by hiring two programmers, that's okay. You know, it was like that sort of freeing. And so I think that's what I would do. I would give my company the challenge of the next big thing is coming from here and not from Silicon Valley or somewhere else. And let's figure out how we're going to do that. And that's going to be our mission statement.
I like it. Yeah. I like it. Well, thanks for doing this.
Okay. Thank you, David. That was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. Okay. And maybe we'll do it another time. You know, we can see if that next big thing has happened.
I would love to do that. I think we should all, you know, just put it on our counter. A year out from now, we'll go back and
see where
big
we
an
stand.
Idiot I am. Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, this has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Jess Breyer about the book industry. Thanks.